Hello, it's Owen Shehan here from Off The Ball, and the FIFA World Cup 2026 is here. And let's be honest, the matchday version of ourselves can look a little committed. Jerseys, face paint, scarves and questionable weather, whatever you have, maybe even a full costume if your team makes a run, you can look a little worse for wear come the end of it all. But the World Cup, it's not just about the football. It's the atmosphere, it's the nights in the pub, it is the watch parties with your mates, and maybe even meeting someone new. That is where Lynx comes in. As an official personal care sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, Lynx's premium fragrances are here to help you smell your best, even in the middle of full matchday madness. Lynx, smell your best when you look your worst. Now, enjoy your podcast.
Have you seen anything like that?
I'm a very confident front runner. I've caddied for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Hello there, everybody. Welcome along to the Ryan Line. Nathan with you as always on a Thursday. And Shane Ryan is right there back home. You'll have spotted him, of course, on the TV coverage, just like at the Ryder Cup, hurling abuse at the golfers on the course. Every time he visits New York, shit kicks off when this guy turns up. He just rabble rouses. He gets everybody involved. And they're like, well, if he's doing it, I'm going to do it too.
Yeah, the fans were very polite there, and I went out and said, guys, we got to jazz this up. And I gave them all some notes of things to say about Wyndham Clark, and it turned really hostile, but it was all because of me.
You're a disgrace. Was it, you're well positioned to compare both. It certainly didn't come across, I felt, on any of the TV coverage to be anywhere near what had happened at the Ryder Cup, but was it excessive to any other major you've seen?
No, it was nowhere near the Ryder Cup. I'll tell you, it was nowhere near what I witnessed with Bryson DeChambeau before he went to live. So like, I think 2021, sort of that fall series, Memphis, Caves Valley in Maryland, that kind of whole period. It was awful. It was right when his feud with Brooks Koepka, right? When everybody was calling him Brooksy for whatever reason. This was not as bad as that. But here's the thing that is kind of weird to understand. Okay, Rory got so much more abuse, so much more bad language at the Ryder Cup, yet somehow what we saw with Wyndham felt more personal because, like, Scotty did the thing too where he was like, you know, it was hard for me at Port Rush, fans weren't nice to me. But it's like, okay, but at Port Rush, they weren't nice to you because it's Rory's turf or Lowry's turf and you're the American trying to win. At Bethpage, it's like horrendous behavior and I'm not excusing it. But in your head, you can justify it by being like, I know these people like me, but they're just doing this because it's the Ryder Cup. And that, you know, at Shinnecock, they loved Rory. Rory got incredible treatment. Everybody loves him. So you almost don't have to take it personally. What happened to Wyndham Clark is, as an American and a former U.S. Open winner playing on an American course, he just, like, people hated him. Like, and they weren't calling him, like, slurs or anything. Really, all they were saying was, like, don't choke or, like, get in the bunker after he shot. But to me, it was almost more powerful because it's like he and Scotty, like Scotty makes a birdie. Everybody goes nuts. I followed their group the whole day. He makes a birdie and nobody even claps. Like it's just silence. And, you know, a few smattered applause or whatever. But like that's such a personal judgment on a guy. It's crazy. Like it was almost worse than somebody saying don't choke. Like just the silence when he does something good or the cheering when the ball goes off the back of the green. And I wrote this, it was on the eighth hole and Kevin Van Valkenburg and I were behind Wyndham hitting out of a bunker and he had a great shot and ended up saving par, but he hit the shot and we couldn't see it because of the angle. And we didn't see it land. And I said to Kevin, and I wasn't even joking. I said, well, it must be a good shot because nobody cheered. And it was like, we both thought about that. I'm like, holy shit, it's crazy that that's the model you're using in your head where it's like, oh, if they cheered, it would be because it went off the green and nobody likes him. So the fact that they didn't cheer means that it's, you know, it's safe. So that was crazy. Not as vocally bad as the Ryder Cup, but in my mind, somehow worse.
So we do have questions about that. Hey, Shane, very interested in your thoughts on the abuse Wyndham Clark was getting. He's clearly made some mistakes, but is there something we don't know about that has the Americans turning on him?
So this is the other crazy thing where people immediately try to understand why this is happening, right? Like, why don't you like Wyndham Clark? And they're like, oh, it's because he kicked in the locker. Or, you know, like he didn't take accountability for it after, or all this other stuff. And you're like, do people really all like, do all these fans know about that? And maybe they do, but do they really care about that? Like, do they really, is that a real reason? Would it be the same if Rory kicked in a locker? You know what I mean? Like, would it be the same if Scotty had, I don't, maybe it would be, but I always feel like these explanations don't get all the way there where it's like, okay, Wyndham also, like the reason I would like roll my eyes at him is he tweeted like election conspiracy theories, or he liked like election conspiracy theory posts ages ago. Like you're like, oh, the protests, the liberal protests were staged, whatever. And I'm like, all right, just another moron. But even that, it's like this crowd, if they knew about it at all, that's not why they hate him. Right. Probably some of them, most of them probably agree. So it's like, again, it almost gets more personal where it's like, I think they just don't like the cut of his jib. I think there's something about this guy, and you can try to like pin it to this or that. And Wyndham Clark was trying to be like, oh, of course they're rooting for Scotty going for the career slam. And I'm like, that's not going to get there, man, because they're also cheering for Rory. They're also cheering for Sam Burns. Nobody else was getting what you were getting. And so, yeah, I just think they just don't like, there's something about him they don't like that you can't quite easily define. And it's, again, it sounds horrible, but it's like, there's something about you that they don't like. It's your face or you're the way you talk, or there's just something deeper there that we can't quite pin on one thing.
Yeah. It's that thing of, it's just your personality.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing for you to change, because the locker thing can't be that big a deal. Again, the right player does that. A Rory does it. Even Scotty does it. It's a, oh, that's the emotion. That's how much they care.
Totally.
And yeah. I might have mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. I was in the media tent at Portrush last year when he came in, I think on the Sunday, and there wasn't too many media around, and he was sort of been backed into a corner to apologize, and he was been asked at the time, well, you know, what happens when the US Open comes around again at Oakland? Are you going to be allowed in? Are you going to be allowed play? And it just felt a little bit over the top of, again, this sort of, you need to apologize to the game of golf. You brought the whole thing into disrepute. You're like, really, in the grand scheme of things, as you said, nobody really knows about this. But that's why I wondered, was there a sort of I'm wary of making the comparison, that the Patrick Reed of, actually, there's 20 years of sort of, not misbehavior, but maybe misbehavior is the right word, that just a lot of little things have happened over a consistent basis that people now look at him and go, nah, not for me.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's it. And that's a big part of it. I also think that the horrible part, the worst part of it, is like a visceral reaction. You know, there's some people where you're like, I don't like you just by looking at you. And it's like funny because like, I don't see Wyndham immediately look at him and go, oh, I don't like this guy or don't trust him. I don't, like, for me, he's like kind of fine. Like, until I don't know. It's weird and sort of inexplicable. Maybe it's like, maybe a big part of it is just that he was the one keeping it from being a competitive US Open too, a little bit. That might be a cop out. I don't know.
Yeah, the Scotty line was a bit strange because, well, we were both in Portrush and there was no anti-Scotty sentiment at any time. Rory at one stage over the weekend got himself kind of in the mix, and understandably, but I think, and I'm not patting Irish golf fans on the back for we're such a brilliantly educated, and we know the game. We know the game. Yeah. Yeah. I think there is an appreciation of Scotty Scheffler's doing Scotty Scheffler things. And while we may not be roaring the way we did for Shane Lowry or Rory McIlroy, there's a true appreciation of, geez, we got to witness proper greatness right in front of us.
I did not walk with him that day, so it's very hard for me to say. I will say, like, when Brian Harman won, it was pretty nasty. people weren't down with Brian Harman, so it's not all just that Americans are crass buffoons and Irish and English are these heightened appreciators of
Thank
the
you.
Sport.
That's the
it's
clip.
Not all that.
That's the clip. Shane Ryan turns on his own.
Yeah, my people are buffoons, and your people are enlightened beacons of perfection.
Yes. What are your thoughts? Well, actually, before that one, just to finish up on the fan abuse, from Not Per Profit. Is New York finished as a major Ryder Cup destination? Second time in 9 months, boozed up locals cross the line with their heckling.
I don't know, man. I think this is so overblown. It's just like I was in Hazeltine. It was awful. I was in Memphis and Maryland when they were going after Bryson. It was awful. You know what I mean? It's just like it just so happens that we had a really bad Ryder Cup. I think that would have happened absolutely anywhere in America. It's the same demo. It's not like it's almost like who do they think are going to these things? Like street hoodlums from New York City, you know what I mean? Or like the guys, like the mafia guys from Long Island. It's just like rich bros. Yeah. That are going to these. You know what I'm saying?
Let's go back to where we were America. This time last year, Shane, when a lot of the questions we were getting in were about the type of people who'd be going to this event. And, oh, it's being overblown. It's going to be all, you know, everyone spends so much money for their ticket. And as you say, it's not the stereotypes that we would associate with the these sort of problems. You're like, no. These are the most self-entitled pricks that have ever walked the earth who've paid 700 quid for their corporate ticket. And they think they can do whatever the hell they want.
100%, 100%. And I think you're going to see that. There's going to be a tournament. So it's like, okay, at Aronimink, there was no kind of inciting incident, right? There was no person that you were going to root against. There was no opportunity for this. You just had a guy that was like sort of, first of all, you had a Ryder Cup, right? Which people, I think people forget, Whistling Straits was the COVID Ryder Cup. And so it wasn't the same high spirit. It wasn't the same like, tenor, and also the course was very divided. It's like you couldn't see one hole from another. It was just kind of a unique thing where it was like, yeah, this the fans were basically fine, but there were some ugly incidents there too. There were people screaming at Jon Rahm that he sucked. He was getting into arguments. Hazeltine was a zoo. Hazeltine was awful. I'm trying to think the ones I've been to. Like Medina, I guess I can't really remember a ton of controversy, but we all know every time there's an American Ryder Cup, the Europeans are going, these are the worst fans I've ever seen. So like going back in time, Brookline, right? Brookline is like, they still talk about it. They still talk about it like it's the most, well, some of it's the players, but like the fans, the most boorish behavior. Whoever Montgomery was playing had to talk to the fans and be like, please be nice to him. You know what I mean? 2004, you get blown out. So that's not the same. But going back to the War by the Shore in 91, that was the first time that American fans really got what the Ryder Cup was. And that though they were apparently terrible fans too. They were calling up European players in their hotel room, right? This is in South Carolina to wake them up in the middle of the night. I'm trying to think like, so then you had Valhalla, which I guess you don't hear as much because it was a blowout. Then you get into Medina. But the point I'm making is every single one, they say the same things. And now it just so happens that we have a New York Ryder Cup. People are worse than ever before. And it's followed hot in the heels of the Shinnecock U.S. Open where you have a guy that nobody likes. But let me tell you, like President's Cup, right after Patrick Reed did his thing at the Hero World Challenge, they were vicious in Melbourne, Australia to Patrick Reed. This shit is not confined to New York. And anybody who says it is really, I think, missing the point.
And golf, in a way, wants this. It doesn't want the maybe to be quite as extreme, but the difficulty is with the way the sport is played and what makes it different and the silence and the respect for the player is that any little piece of abuse that's out of the ordinary stands out a lot more than if you were at a football pitch. And golf has been sort of trying to push for quite a while, many tournaments, such as Phoenix and the 16th and all that, of golf, but not like you know it. And what 100%. We've seen Liv do. Yeah. So, you know, with all of the music of, actually, no, you can come to our tournaments and you can behave like you would at a football match or any mm-hmm. other sport. You can shout and you can get drunk and you can do all of this without realizing, actually, we used to have everyone standing in silence for pretty much 5 hours here. And if we fill them with drink, maybe some bad things will happen. So the idea that they would turn their back and all that sweet, sweet cash from New York because of a couple of Larry fans... They're probably doubling down and going, actually, you know what? Look what we did on Saturday, which leads into our next question. Look what we did on Saturday. We got all these guys in, didn't even stay for half the day, and we still took all their money. Totally. Beautiful day.
Yeah, I know.
On that, what are your thoughts on the late start times at the US Open on Saturday? The place was empty by the time Clark finished up. The Open do the same thing. Should they be prioritizing the thousands of fans at the event or the millions at home?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the deal is they want it to go into prime time. And you're like, okay, I guess. But yeah, the difference is, I mean, this is the one thing where the New York criticism is valid, or the New York element is valid, the traffic out there is horrendous. So if you've driven your car, there's no way you want to wait till the end and spend, 2 hours getting back to wherever you're going. If you took the railroad out, the Long Island Railroad, it's like there's certain schedules there where you have to leave early. Logistically, Shinnecock is a nightmare, and it's an awesome course. And I thought the USGA did a really good job with the course this time. It's because it's hard. It's that course can really go south in such a hurry, and they did a good job, and maybe got a few breaks from the weather. But logistically, it sucks out there. It's no fun. You're gonna have people leaving early, and yeah, like a Saturday night was just like, oh, there's three guys in the grandstand. Jamie Kennedy, who was there, pointed out that the grandstand behind the 18th green is for members only of Shinnecock. Like they saved it for them. But they're like not there. They're all over the place, right? Or they're not going every day. So behind the 18th green, this is like the highlighted grandstand. It's basically vacant. So it's kind of crazy in that sense. I don't like the late starting times at all. Although I guess for whatever reason, it doesn't bother me as much at the Open, even when I'm there. I guess as an American, it wouldn't bother you at the Open because it's still finishing by 3 o'clock every day. But yeah, at the US Open, it feels like, what are we doing with these guys teeing off at 3:40? It sucks.
I think you're right on the time difference, making a different opinion on the Open, because I often find that that Saturday evening, which should be one of the most exciting parts of the tournament, often does feel a little bit flat. Because again, no matter where it is, look, there's exceptions. Lowry's third round in 2019 at Portrush was obviously wild, completely wild at the end of it. But you'll see at an Open on a Saturday evening from sort of 5 o'clock, people are streaming out of the place because again, like Shinnecock, Opens are generally played at quite rural areas where there's not a huge amount of trains. If you decide to stay till 8 o'clock, you could be waiting 2 hours for a train. You're not getting home till 1 in the morning. People want to come back in the Sunday. That at a moment when it should be at a sort of peak excitement, it's like, well, actually, and there's something different about the evening. I don't know. When it gets past sort of, it's like everyone's getting a bit tired. It's like 7 o'clock. Like, we're kind of done with this. Let's.
Well, I'm a big one for like if okay, we've talked about this before. What would you do if you went to a golf tournament? And here's how you would do it. But the bigger point is, I would never go to a golf tournament as a spectator. Like, what, maybe I would if I didn't have access. Maybe this is just selfish, like entitled media talking. But
No,
if
but
I
if you did
did,
go, Shane, yeah, would you'd go and you'd have a few beers with your mates and you'd probably go in at 1 o'clock, and then by the time it gets to 6 o'clock, you're like, well, I've watched a load of golf. It turns out I can't get within 8 people of Scottie Scheffler. And now I just want to go on a few more drinks with my mates. And I've got what I wanted for my 120 quid.
There's no way you're staying till 8 o'clock on a Saturday. No way.
A question from Four Putt Stab, which I think might have come in on Saturday at some stage. How about setting up a course with varieties? Some wide fairways, some narrow fairways, some long rough, some short rough, some green mowed tight, some greens mowed longer.
Oh, the green one is crazy. The green, like that, the rest of it, I'm like, yeah, okay, I can see that. All courses have their identity, right? And so, and it's these things tend to be consistent, the rough and the fairway width.
I think
But the
he's following
greens
up
will
on our
be.
point last week, isn't this, where we were saying, what if you just played all four majors at Augusta, but at different times of the year?
I think that would be amazing. Having different green speeds would be the funniest thing ever because they couldn't handle it. It would be a complete revolution to be like on number one, it's rolling at an eight, and by number 12, it's an 11. Like that would be crazy.
It will be very fair. Now, again, I don't know how you would actually do it practically, but I always, because I put a euro, I have one bet every week these days. I have one guaranteed bet every week these days, which is on Brian Campbell. Because Brian Campbell, every week in a signature event, he gets to play them all because he won last year, is about 700 or 800 to 1 in a very small. So you'll have whoever the worst player in the field is 200 to 1 because it's a tight field, so they're not going over that. And then you have Brian Campbell at about 700 to 1. I'm like, well, he did win last year, and there are very specific circumstances where he can get himself in contention. But if you had again something like that where he's like, well, actually, it's fine. Or him and a Brian Harman or somebody who's going, well, half the holes are actually quite short here, and my driving accuracy is going to be recorded, and ideal.
I think it's I think it would be great. I want to see a course with just insanely tight fairways and incredibly punitive rough so that a guy who can hit it like 220 yards straight actually has like a benefit because it's, you know what I mean? Just maybe not a whole tournament. I just want to see 9 holes of what that would look like.
What about this? And do you think this would impact results and scoring? What if, like us schleps, they weren't allowed practice in advance? So, like when I'm going to play, if I'm going to play links golf, playing it once or twice a year, and I rock up a new course, I've never seen it before, I've heard about it, and I'm used to playing Parkland golf, and I've had no chance to practice or anything. So they just have to rock up on a Thursday morning, and this is the first they've seen on the course, and off you go.
It would almost, I think, have the reverse effect of putting a premium on whoever works the hard at intelligence, where it's like, we're going to watch the drone fly over. We're going to plan for this so meticulously because we have to, they're so obsessive that it would almost double down their preparation. But I like it.
Yes.
Yeah. You're like, until you get there, you don't actually know what it's going to be. So it might be fun to see how that would work.
That's my favorite thing. The very odd time I play a very nice course, whereas I'll do the drone and I'll be like, yeah, what I'll do here now is I might take a 6 iron off the tee in the first if the wind is behind me. And then by the time I get there, the adrenaline is pumping. I have no memory at any stage of the 18 holes of looking at it, and I'm like, I'm just in driver here and I'm sure it'll be fine.
I remember, yeah, like, so the only time I played links golf, I played at oh my God, why can't I, the first British Open, Prestwick. I played at Prestwick and Western Dunes, and I'm not sure it would have helped me to know ahead of time what it was, but it was so confusing in a fun way. But it was like, what the hell am I doing here? This is nuts. And I hadn't seen drones or anything like that, so it was all new.
How would you rate Scotty's season so far out of 10?
It's going by Scotty standards, so like a 6. Neutral standards, of course, would be like a 9 or something. But yeah, Scotty standards a 6. I asked him that exact question at the US Open. And he threw the microphone at me and hit me with a potted plant. No, he gave a good answer. He said it's I didn't ask for a numerical answer, but he basically said he's just not sharp. It's a little dull. It's just like things aren't happening in the same way. He almost sounded like he was putting it to luck a little bit, like he hasn't gotten the big break at the right moment. I think Jet, like, what was crazy about Scotty was his presser on Sunday was like very, he seemed very in a good mood, and I was a little bit surprised. But he was basically like, I feel better now than I did on Monday. I feel, like I played well, all that stuff. So I think he thinks he's getting better. It just took a long time this year. And now it's like, there's only one major left to do it. So yeah, I but like by his own standards, especially recently, it's a 6, I think, at most.
Yeah, it looked like when he held the chip shot that it suddenly a weight was off his shoulders and he was smiling, going, okay, things are starting to flow for me. On Thursday morning, I was on Off the Ball and one of the co-hosts was sort of talking about Scotty of, he's not the dominant player, he's even the best player in the world anymore. And again, it feeds into how would you rate him out of 10? World ranking points earned this year. Number one, Scottie Scheffler, 299. Number two and number three, pretty much tied, are Cam Young and Matt Fitzpatrick on 232. So even his 6 out of 10 still has him as the best player in the world this year.
What's crazy though is this will sound like hindsight, but you can read my vibes post. I did feel coming in that Wyndham Clark might be the best player in the world at this exact moment. And he proved that. But again, like there is fluctuations. I might have said the same thing about Cam Young 2 months ago, about Fitzpatrick after the Heritage, because those guys have all played well. So that doesn't necessarily mean anything. It's just that coming in, it's like on one hand, yes, Scotty's the best player in the world. On the other hand, I don't think he's the most likely guy to win this tournament, which are separate but sort of related thoughts.
And that's the problem with the condensed calendar now, that if you could become, as we wouldn't be surprised if Scotty goes and wins five tournaments between August, end of July and August. And it's like, ah, shit, you peaked a little bit too late there, pal. The beard asks, question for Shane. Joaquin Neiman assessed 2 strokes for throwing a club. What happens if a top player does it in the final round?
I almost wrote this piece, and then my friends talked me out of it. I almost wrote that there should be no penalty for throwing a club ever, unless you hurt somebody or unless you intentionally throw it at somebody. And my reasoning was because it does get to like a judgment zone. Like apparently, if you believe the marshal that spoke to Gabby at the Athletic, which I do, he just chucked it like 50 yards. Like he really hurled it. So it was like an emphatic throw. But then, you know, I think Rory did it last year. And this was before the rule changed. Rory didn't get penalized. You saw Rom kind of kicking his club down the fairway this week, didn't get penalized. And to your point, it's like, yeah, what if somebody is like two shots ahead, hits a bad shot and just goes like that? Like, do you penalize? Like, it's so stupid. I think there should be, as long as you don't damage something, right? Like, you know, hitting a divot into the green is 8 billion times worse than throwing your club. As long as you don't damage something, as long as you're not throwing it at somebody, I kind of have trouble with that being a penalty. Like, is there no room for the expression of anger? Mm. What about if somebody swears? What about if somebody just drops an F-bomb really loud and the TV picks it up? Do we start to have like a moral code where we enforce that with the penalty too? I just don't, I don't know. I don't, there's something about me that doesn't like it. And I also kind of don't care if somebody throws a club. I kind of like it. And I kind of think it's like, oh, here we go. But then somebody made the argument. They're like, well, if you legalize throwing clubs, then somebody could do it and accidentally hurt somebody. And you've enabled that because you didn't penalize them for the act of doing it. I don't know if I'd buy that, but it kind of gave me some pause.
The beard is on fire. Why does no one fill in the divots? It's very unfair on the later players. Can't be a manpower issue.
Don't they? I mean, but I know what he's saying, because you always see just tons of divots on the thing.
Mm.
Maybe they asked them not to, because I feel like they're always going and fetching their divots.
Mm. I am going with you on what. So they replace the divot, but then your ball lands in there and they haven't slightly replaced it perfectly, that you end up in a far worse situation than just being in the divot.
Yeah, like you get snuck between the divot and the brown spot or something. Yeah.
Or point. If you're, again, which I'm sure people do all the time, if you put the divot back in, it sort of fits back in place perfectly, but then the ball lands right on that. How right. difficult is it to hit that where there's almost a false lie?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's like you got to... I just Googled to see if... they want them to replace divots. It seems like they do. I don't know. This is a good beard. You've done
that's a great question. They must tell the pros not to replace the divots, because as you say, when you have, and it feels increasingly, ball rolls to the bottom of the hill and it's basically weaving its way through 25 divots. And it's remarkable how often it doesn't land in a divot.
Yeah, right.
There must be a science behind that the ball is somehow slightly pushed away from it at all times.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to this one. That bears further investigation. Good job, Beard.
You've given Beard asks one final one. What does Shane think of a 33-year-old ex-pro winning the amateur? Bear in mind that he is from Ireland.
Yeah. I talked about this last night. I'm far from an expert on the rules of this, but there is something where it's like weird about it, or something sort of off-putting about it, because you're like, the guy getting the berth in the Open from winning the amateur should be either a college kid who's lighting it up, or it should be an accountant who's 45 and just does this on weekends and he caught fire. To have somebody who, this guy won some level of European pro event, I forget what tour it was, but he's won tournaments. He was competing in the arena. It seems like that guy shouldn't be there. It seems like he shouldn't be taking that exemption. Then on the other hand, I feel for him, where I'm like, okay, his pro career didn't work out. How long do you have to wait before can you never compete again on an amateur level? Is that fair? So I kind of get that too. I don't know. What do you think, Nathan? I'm kind of torn.
I'm with you. Look, we had Stuart on the podcast last year.
I can't hear you right now, for whatever it's worth.
I muted myself, I think. Can you hear me now?
There you go. Yeah.
I had a button here. I was flicking that I didn't even realize muted me. So we had Stuart on the podcast last year, and it's a very interesting story because he's clearly such a talented golfer. So from the moment he came back to the amateur ranks, he was basically the top dog in the Irish amateur game. And he goes out on the professional tour for 7 years, and I don't think he ever even played a tournament on the DP World Tour. So, you know, he was really interesting on all of the things that happened that probably are in line with a lot of the struggles of suddenly I'm trying to earn a living, Week to week, hotel to hotel, struggled with the lifestyle a bit, just never got the game the way he wanted to, and then followed the rule book, which says you can't do this. So he's back, he's working, you know, I think he's an accountant himself, or he's certainly working in the financial services industry. So, you know, he's working a 9-to-5 job as much as any of these guys are, and is eligible to enter. So I suppose the only question you would have on it is that, and I don't even know if it is as relevant as it once would have been, because I think an awful lot of these, particularly the top young amateurs, are almost playing full time. Like, they're giving themselves a job where you're not doing a real 9-to-5. You're not in all day, every day. You're giving yourself the space to dedicate yourself to the game. But I guess he had a 7-year spell where all he had to do was practice, and all he had to do was think about the game of golf in a way that most amateurs don't, that they always have to have a bit of them going. Now, again, he would say, well, he had a more stressful 7 years because it was his bloody livelihood, but that he probably had, there was probably available resources that wouldn't be there for all of them all of the time that he had access to, that surely now benefit him when he's back in the amateur game. But unless you just ban anyone who turns professional from returning, or you go, yeah, you can be an amateur, but these are the top tournaments. If you've ever been a pro, you can't be the amateur at Augusta or at the Open. And maybe they'll look at something like that, but I think it'd be very harsh to do it in retrospect. You know, he's gone in, he's followed all the rules, he's done everything that's been asked of him, but maybe it's something they'd consider in future and go, I don't know, is it more likely or less likely that you'll see more stories like this? I don't know.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, again, it's no shade on him. I also know it's kind of an interesting difference. The USGA has a guideline of like 6 months, which feels like no time at all. And the RNA is like, we consider it on a case-by-case basis without a real like defining guideline. That's kind of neither here nor there, but just thought it was interesting. Yeah, so again, no shade on Stewart, but yeah, there's just something about it. I think maybe I like your thing of like the qualified, where you can do all this stuff, but you can't get exempt into a pro tournament through it, maybe. Or I don't know, maybe even that's too harsh. It's so hard.
It's a great prize, isn't it?
Mm.
Getting to play the Masters, getting to play the Open.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It'd be funny if the funniest thing would be if he had great success and used it to fuel another pro career.
And again,
just going back and forth. Yeah.
Like if he rocked up at the Open and won it.
Yeah.
Obviously he's
got
to go, I'm back, baby.
Yeah.
Show me the money. And he'd be dead bloody
right. He could do this six
forever.
Times in the next decade.
Yeah. Like, wait a more guy. It's like, oh, I'm losing my exemption on the PGA Tour. I think I might go amateur for a year.
Time to go amateur again.
Everything. Get back
time
in
to
the
go
Masters.
Win the USAM. Get back in.
One more question, which is about the PGA Tour announcement this week, which we've spoken about a lot over the last while. Does Shane have any insight into what influence, if any, Tiger has within the PGA Tour? Are himself and Rory calling the shots?
Are you serious? You look at Tiger Woods right now in his rehab in Switzerland and think this guy is the marionette pulling the strings? No. First of all, Rory, all he does is like get in the way. Rory's comment about it being a glorified Korn Ferry Tour was like funny and like maybe kind of true, but like the single most unhelpful thing you can do. I would love to be a fly on the wall at PGA Tour headquarters for that, going, does this guy ever just shut up?
Well, I presume there was a fallout for that, even though he's not technically on any of the committees.
But he withdrew himself from the board. That's the
exactly.
Thing.
So he withdrew himself.
That's where it's like, okay, you opted out of having a voice in this, and now you're sniping from the sidelines. They must just be like, get this guy out of here.
I assume Rolap was in touch with him, though, because it was very notable that a Rory statement essentially accompanied this announcement of, I approve.
Yeah, well, and Rolap even said that because they asked him about that in his presser. And he's like, yeah, I talked to Rory. He didn't really go into details, but they definitely communicated. Rory, it's just like, oh, thanks for your opinion, man. See you at the next signature event. Oh, you're skipping that one? Okay, great. Thanks for your help. Tiger, no. Tiger, they bring in as like a symbol. They, you know what I mean? It's like still important to have his sort of okay, But man, like Tiger's not calling any shots. Rory's not calling any shots. Rory has more influence at this point. I think Tiger kind of goes along. PGA Tour takes care of him. They like him, all that. But it's like he is essentially just like a guy you wheel in to go, hey, here's Tiger. Everybody loves him. Tiger, read this thing we wrote for you. That's it.
Yeah, my understanding is that Tiger is rewarded very well for his role. They basically wheel him in and then they wheel him out with a wheelbarrow of cash in there as well.
Yeah, that I don't know. I mean, like, I don't know if he needs a wheelbarrow. Okay, you might be right, but I mean, what I do know is that, yeah, I mean, like, he occupies such a singular thing in the game where it's like, let's say he came back and was playing well. The tour could easily just go, there's an 80 winner exemption. Bob Herrig made that joke at the presser. Like, is there an exemption for an 80 time winner on tour, which would just be a tie? And everybody would be fine with it, right? No, literally nobody would care. So yeah, it's, but no, he's, this guy is not pulling the strings. That's crazy.
He's not sitting in the boardroom going, yeah, what will we make a championship event? What about the Canadian Open guys? I like those guys up there. Let's throw them a bone.
No, he's not, I don't think so.
All right, that is us done for this week's Ryan Line. You get your questions in on the Discord. You can get in touch on Instagram. You can drop us an email to golfweekly@offtheball.com. I gotta go to the Shane today. Today's going to be the hottest day in the history of Ireland.
Oh my God, are you serious?
Yes.
Wow, what, 70, 72 degrees Fahrenheit?
I don't know what that means, but we're going 34 degrees Celsius.
Double it and add 30. So that would be like close to 100 degrees. That's
Yeah.
crazy.
Yeah.
Are you gonna wake up at 3 a.m. to watch the US play Turkey in a meaningless group match?
No, I sat up last night to watch Brazil against Scotland, which was 11 p.m. So it was a bit, even that sort of stretched me. And this, as you say, is a very meaningless. It's the one thing they've screwed up with this World Cup. They've got a lot of stuff right, but doing the head-to-head thing has killed it because all these games usually are the most dramatic, where there's a load at stake and they go down to the last couple of minutes because it's all on goal difference. And now you're like, oh no, you've just got a whole load of dead rubbers for no reason.
I hate head-to-head in anything because it's that reason. It's also like you're saying, oh, this game is more important than that game. It never makes sense.
I think what happened was they were worried by expanding the tournament that there were going to be some very, very weak teams, and that say Germany against Curaçao, that you'd have a lot of 7 and 8 nil wins, and that would have too much of a bearing on it, but that hasn't really been the case.
That's a good point where you're trying to discourage a little bit, like, yeah, like just call off the dogs at 6-0 or whatever. Yeah, that's interesting. I think, again, this is probably annoying. An American has soccer opinions, but I think at this point, the other thing I don't like is three teams from the group getting in. But I've liked the expanded World Cup, actually, and I didn't think I would. So I'm like, make it 64 teams, have 16 groups, and only two get in from each group. Go back to two getting into the group, but just add more teams if you're like, because it's kind of fun to see, like, who was it? Like, didn't Spain draw somebody that was like a total
Cape Verde.
shocker?
Yes,
Yeah,
I swear. So Cape Verde
exactly.
centre
Oh,
back
yeah.
is from Dublin. So
That's right. That's right.
no,
That stuff's
I'm with you.
cool.
I made this point, but particularly in Ireland where there's almost, we love our football and there was a 48 teams, it's ruining the whole thing. And you're like, sorry, if we had qualified as and we would have been one of the teams between 32 and 48, not only would we have thought we can get some results, and even looking at the group we would have been in, definitely thought we would have qualified. We would have thought we would massively enhance everyone's experience because we're such great supporters and we'd have such a good time. And all the teams you're adding in are the teams who are actually the most fun because their supporters are like, we can't believe we've actually got here.
Totally. And it's like, but yeah, even that, you'd have more teams like that, but you'd also have Ireland, Italy. You know what I mean? You'd have these teams that are these classic soccer nations that should be in.
You're
Um,
right.
well,
We
I'm not saying
are
they
a
should.
classic. We are a classic soccer nation.
You made the rounds. I mean, America's the best soccer nation now. And so it's like, we welcome all our Irish supporters.
Well,
America is Ireland. You all came here in the beginning. This is for you, Nathan. The
yeah. No,
US national team is for you.
we're 90% of the people abusing at Shinnecock. Like they're of Irish heritage.
Exactly.
We're like that's a disgrace. Ooh, what's your surname? Oh, okay, balls.
It's all the it's Irish and Italians on Long Island. That's
Yes.
it. Like,
God damn
those
it.
are the culprits.
On that note, Shane Ryan, best of luck to the USA. Keep on rolling. Keep your soccer opinions coming every week, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye, Nathan.
Right here in Dawson.
Hello, it's Owen Shehan here from Off The Ball, and the FIFA World Cup 2026 is here. And let's be honest, the matchday version of ourselves can look a little committed. Jerseys, face paint, scarves in questionable weather, whatever you have, maybe even a full costume if your team makes a run, you can look a little worse for wear come the end of it all. But the World Cup, it's not just about the football. It's the atmosphere, it's the nights in the pub, it is the watch parties with your mates, and maybe even meeting someone new. That is where Lynx comes in. As an official personal care sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, Lynx's premium fragrances are here to help you smell your best, even in the middle of full matchday madness. Lynx, smell your best when you look your worst. Now, enjoy your podcast.